Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Mildly Amusing Show. And I will explain, Shelley, why we call this the Mildly Amusing Show. The Mildly Amusing Show because I guess you would call this person a fan. That's the closest thing I can say, who came up to me and said, you know, I find your show mildly amusing. And I suppose This person's world, that was a compliment.
Well, it could have been a lot worse.
I find your show not amusing at all.
Yes.
But at any rate, so I thought, well, you think that's mildly amusing. We'll just make a mildly amusing show for you. And that's it. That's where it came from. That's it. Special thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio and a special radio wave to the MSU Ronald G. Eglin Space Science Center. Now, Rick currently is trying to straighten out the Isonville Bureau.
It's a mess.
Car comes by, got to change the traffic report, then there's another car.
Yep.
What are you going to do?
I know.
From the University of Kentucky, here back at the main office to help us out with the radio show, the assistant professor with the physician assistant program, Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And in the absence of my co-medical host, Rick Phillips, here to introduce you to our website is the RickBot.
To get the audio of the show, go to WMKY.org. It's pretty simple. That's the Moorhead State Public Radio website. Health Matters will show you a list of the most recent shows. Click on the link and you can re-listen to the show. After that, get involved in the conversation through Facebook. Facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
Our sponsor for today's show, the Vaccination League, reminding you, don't be late. Vaccinate. Vaccination, the all-natural way to take care of infections without all those artificial antibiotics or vitamins. Vaccination, it's like Mother Nature with a 23-gauge needle, and we are continuing to emphasize the importance of influenza vaccine. I've had mine. Shelley, you've had yours?
Yes, absolutely.
For the 2018-2019 flu season, providers may choose to administer any licensed age-appropriate flu vaccine. There are standard dose flu shots given into the muscle. There are high dose flu shots for older people. And you know, Shelley, this has been a problem at our clinic. We ran out of the high dose older people vaccine. And I mainly take care of older people. So a lot of my patients said, well, what about that high dose stuff? And I said, well, the CDC says any vaccine. And they say, yeah, but I want the older people high dose flu shot. And so we sent them out into the world hoping that they could find the high-dose flu shot, which we did not have.
Do you know if they were successful?
They will straggle back in the next visit, and they will tell me whether they were able to find it or not. I do apologize to my older patients that we did not have that for a time at St. Clair. We simply ran out, and it is on order. You can also have shots made with an adjuvant for older people. No, we did not have that either. I am not as familiar with the adjuvant technology for flu shots, and I've told people it seems that most of the science behind them is with the standard dose or with a high dose. And so while the adjuvant may be beneficial, I have stuck with the standard dose for most of my patients. And there is, of course, for those ages 2 through 49 with intact immune systems and not pregnant individuals, the live attenuated influenza vaccine, that is the FluMist nasal spray, which Shelley will not give to her child.
Not yet.
But if your child is deathly afraid of needles, it is available this year. And we've said before, it's interesting, CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices said they've reformulated. It looks like they have this year is going to be especially beneficial against certain strains of influenza. Go ahead and use the FluMist. The American Academy of Pediatrics says we need to see more data before we're convinced, and they are not recommending it. So keep that in mind. There is a difference of opinion regarding the utility, the benefit from the FluMist. That's our sponsor, the Vaccination League, reminding you time is growing short. You are now, even if you rushed out in the middle of our show, you are still almost 2 weeks away from Thanksgiving. We are that close. And you do not want to go into the Thanksgiving season unvaccinated. Think of all the family gatherings, the church potlucks, the Christmas open houses, all the things you will be attending where there will be other people, no doubt, with their own germs present. And wouldn't it be nice to have the flu vaccine, to have your immune system on the ready when you go through the Thanksgiving holiday season? I know I certainly feel better about having mine set up, and I know you yourself want to protect yourself during this holiday season. So please don't be late. vaccinate. Okay, we are headed for winter, and I've got a couple of wintry things going on here. First of all, this was published October 24th in the AMA Journal of Cardiology, and it was a study that came out of Sweden. This is just genius. I'm always amazed at these researchers at how clever they are. They took individual heart attack patients who were admitted to coronary care units. And they have this national registry of patients, so they can do this in Sweden, whereas we could not do it in the U.S. Nationwide, they took the data on their heart attack patients, and then they matched it to the meteorologic data obtained at the nearest weather station on that day. And they could go back and follow these meteorologic records back to 1998. So they went 1998 to 2013 because they had to do their data analysis. So you're looking at a period there of about 15 years of all the heart attacks in Sweden and the weather conditions. For every coronary care unit, we found the closest weather station, coupled its data for the day each patient went to the coronary care unit. For every heart attack in the whole country for, they said, 16 years. And this came out of Lund University. Now, looking at different aspects, this was not simply the temperature or was there snow on the ground. They looked at relative humidity. They looked at the barometric pressure. They looked at all the things they could get from the weather station. And they also looked at different types of heart attacks. Some of them showed up on the EKG. We call them ST elevation heart attacks because I can see on the EKG the ST segments are going up, and that's a sign of a heart attack. Some of them were a little bit trickier to diagnose. We had to get some additional blood tests before we knew for sure. They looked at both types. For both of those combined, lower daily air temperature, lower atmospheric air pressure, and these lows are usually when it's about to have precipitation, higher wind velocity, and shorter duration of sunshine appear to be the independent triggers. They were over 250,000 patients in this registry. The strongest association, air temperature, a higher incidence of heart attack with air temperatures less than freezing.
Now, were these drastic changes in air temperature or gradual or sustained? Did they say?
Well, they mentioned that it was that day. What was the temperature that day when they came in? So if you were in the middle of a cold snap, whatever the temperature was on that day was what they looked at, rather than saying, gee, it's been cold for a week. If the temperature went to more than about 40 degrees, it looks like, they do it in Celsius. I'm doing some quick conversions. The risk of heart attack dropped by around 3%, 2.8%. So you can see as you get closer to freezing, the temperature goes up. When they did some adjustments, and again, when you do a bunch of comparisons like this, you have to do this, the risk of heart attack rose with lower air temperature and atmospheric pressure, less rainfall, and higher wind velocity. Unrelated to heart attack incidents were low humidity, greater snowfall, and cloudy days. Did not matter whether it was sunny or cloudy. It was the amount of sunshine that day rather than a partly cloudy day versus a cloudy day with a sunny afternoon. That relationship was stronger in the southern half of Sweden, but part of it was that the temperature in the northern half of Sweden really stayed pretty cold. There wasn't that much variation. Snowfall, a stronger predictor in the north than the rest of the country. And I guess because, you know, in the south, apparently when the temperature drops, the heart attack rate goes up. This is south of Sweden now. And in the north, when the snow falls, the risk of heart attack goes up. We've talked a lot about heart attacks and shoveling snow. That's what everybody knows about. Mm-hmm. And I always thought, well, you can't stop shoveling snow halfway down the drive. You've got to get your car out.
Right.
So you're going to push through. Even if you're feeling uncomfortable, you're going to try to get the job finished. And so one of the things we talk about with cardiac rehabilitation is, you know, look, I want you to exercise, but you stop as soon as you feel bad. You don't have to get the exercise done. We don't set time limits or things like that. We just go and watch how people do. But apparently there's, once again, cold weather, cold, clear weather, and wind. I didn't expect windiness on a windy day. Just the things that would make you cold apparently can cause you to have a heart attack. And they talked about, you know, well, one, there's that you have to get things done when it snows. But in the southern part, even if the day was sunny, the lower temperatures have a higher rate of heart attack. So it's something about being cold. Now, maybe when you're cold, of course, your blood vessels constrict to try to hold in heat. So it changes that. It might be that the lack of sunshine, especially, I mean, Sweden's pretty far north. So maybe that you just, without daylight, you have heart attacks. Could be. I don't know. So we're about to enter heart attack season. Please, for those you love, If they are at high risk of heart attack, keep an eye on them, especially as the temperature goes down. This is their high risk time. Now, if that's not enough, so you're thinking, okay, I'm going to watch out for my family members with heart attack. This was originally published in the Public Library of Science Medicine. It's an online journal that accepts publications back in September. I ran across it in the AMA journal, a summary of it published October 24th. And they ask, is there a difference between summer and winter in the risk of developing dementia? And I will say, I have my mother now is becoming very elderly. And last winter, we had she was more confused, I think, in the winter than she was during the summer. And we thought, well, of course, it's dark more in the winter. That's it. There's something called sundowning. When it gets dark, people who have dementia have more problems. And so we thought we're just seeing that type of sundowning. But this one, this group actually looked at brain activity in healthy young participants. They had them doing tasks of memory, sustained attention, and working memory. And they had people without cognitive impairment. Among these 2,700 people doing those tests, those tested late summer and early fall scored the highest. Those evaluated in late winter and early spring fared worse. The gap between these people without dementia was about 5 years age difference. 813 people were later diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's disease, and the timing of their diagnoses showed a similar problem. Those evaluated in winter or spring were 30% more likely to meet the criteria for impairment or disease than those tested in summer or fall. So there is something about summer that makes our brains smarter. And of course, now I recognize that was the time I was out of school. Mm-hmm. I was incredibly intelligent when I was out of school. And then once I get in school, things start to fall apart quickly.
Downhill.
Yeah. By the time you get to spring, you're a total imbecile.
There's a lot of great teachers who would probably agree with that.
Yeah. Well, the total imbecile part, the spring part, maybe not. But at any, you know, so this was, you know, I mean, it is true. If you have a friend or relative of Alzheimer's, you're about to go into a period where the chances of deterioration are higher. And I think, again, the sundowning thing that I talked about, but also here's some data that says that. Now, what to do about this with young people without cognitive impairment? The fact that you are not the best person, you are not the best version of yourself in the winter, late winter, early spring. That's an interesting finding, and I haven't really thought through what I would do differently based on that. I guess if I'm going to apply for a job, I'd try to do it in August, September.
In the fall, right? The summer?
In summer, fall. When
late
you
summer,
well, you could
fall.
Say, I want my doctor to see me when I'm at my dumbest and realize, look, this is no prize here.
Or at your best.
Or at best when I make good decisions.
Right.
It could go either way. Speaking of going either way, we're going to go away for a while. We're going to take a break. You should take one, too, and come back and listen to our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
This is Shelley Irving, and welcome back to the second fractional portion of Health Matters.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver, and we are airing our mildly amusing show dedicated to one of our many radio fans who does not know how to express a compliment.
Well, or maybe he or she was being, you know, optimistic about the show.
Maybe so. You know, I will tell you, Shelley, I've noticed as I've gotten older, I am much grouchier than I used to be.
Oh.
It used to be I did not even realize that I should be offended. Now, I know full well I should be offended.
You should be offended.
And you learn things. You think, well, you know, why did that person? This morning, I was eating a breakfast at one of our local establishments before I went into work, and this guy pulls up, and he's got his lights on high beam, and he pulls up right to the door. And, of course, all these restaurants are, you know, all the glass fronts and all that because mm-hmm. these are fast food places. We do not have gourmet breakfast on a weekday in Moorhead. Mm. And so he's putting his high beams right across where I'm eating. And I thought, you know, when you pull into the parking lot of a fast food, wouldn't you turn your high beams off? And then I thought, I would never have had that thought when I was in my 20s.
Yeah, but that's one of your superpowers as you get older, right? You can be grouchy and you can get away with it. You can say what's on your mind.
There's
right?
that. But I have so many more things to be grouchy about. You know, here is a person who attempted to compliment me and just did not the best job, and I'm grouchy. Right away, I'm grouchy. It's just, I can be grouchy at the drop of a dime, especially if it's my dime. And I decided, one of the things I decided today, I'm going along, I'm trying to work with my electronic medical record at St. Clair, and I've decided the computer is a little box that St. Clair Healthcare gave me just to thwart anything that I want to do. It's like, it's an electronic box, and it says, I will oppose you, whatever you want to do, I'm going to try to stop it.
And it has to make you grouchy. That's its job.
I came here absolutely
furious.
It's
pre-programmed to make you grouchy.
I'm running right now on sheer rage. Meanwhile, our sponsor remains the Vaccination League, reminding you, don't be late, vaccinate. Vaccination, the all-natural way to take care of infections without artificial antibiotics or vitamins. That's right. Vaccination, it's like Mother Nature with a 23-gauge needle. Now, what I mean by that is you can take chemicals that destroy the bacteria in your gut and cause changes in the way you absorb food and may give you serious and severe diarrhea that is very difficult to treat. They may cause fungal overgrowth of your oral cavity and the other sheltered areas of your body, the diaper area and so forth. You can take those. You can take vitamins, many of which the ingredients in the vitamin were assembled overseas and placed into capsules, and you have no idea what's in that vitamin.
Not a clue.
Or you can stimulate your own intrinsic immune system to mount a response against infections. Now, which one of those seems natural?
I'll take the last one, please.
The last one, that's a vaccination. That's what we're talking about. And we are talking now about flu shots, reminding you it is darn close to Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is going to be an absolute flu mess. That's one word, flu mess. It's going to be a flu mess, and you are going to wade in the middle of that flu mess. We've got open houses. We've got potlucks. We've got family get-togethers. We've got refrigerator sales, and we've got
children. You've got children. Lots of children.
Black Friday. We've got all these things, and you are going to go in there unarmed. Mm-hmm. Or you're going to take a vitamin and go in there. That's your plan? That's your strategy? I don't think so. It is time, if you haven't slapped yourself recently, it is time to slap yourself and say, what am I going to do to protect myself during this massive infestation of influenza and other viruses? I know I will take care of my immune system, and that's what the Vaccination League is all about. Mm-hmm. Get your flu shot, folks. It is time, and there are many different types, as we talked about in our first fractional portion. That's our sponsor, Vaccination League. Now, we had this before, Shelley. This was back early October. Alexa, Amazon's home invasion system.
Yes, I know her well. She's my best friend.
Okay.
At home.
Amazon has filed patents where Alexa can recognize your speech patterns, and if you are coughing, can offer to sell you cough drops, or, and this is a little bit worrisome, she can also log that you are experiencing emotional abnormality. If your voice starts to crack, she can log emotional abnormality. Now, keep in mind, Amazon has bought something called PillPack, which is a mail-order pharmacy. So you now have basically a salesperson in your home who can recognize when you might be emotionally abnormal.
How's that any different from Apple getting an EKG?
Well, the difference is Apple, you have to push the button to get the EKG. You have to want the EKG. Amazon is going to recognize. And they said, well, perhaps she could offer chicken soup. Yeah, she could offer chicken soup, but there's a lot of other stuff we treat people who are depressed with other than chicken soup.
True.
And Amazon has access to an entire panoply of potential treatments for emotional abnormalities. Just saying. And that's old news. And you think, well, that's kind of cute, but probably not that important. This came out, and I thought, we should talk about it. The title was Happy with a 20% Chance of Sadness. And they mentioned a guy named Matthew Nock. He is at Harvard University, and he studies the psychology of self-harm. That is basically suicide. Lots of risk factors for suicide. If someone starts drinking heavily, someone is depressed. If someone is a male, I mean, that's, you know, things like that. The men do that more than women do. But you can't tell, even if you have a alcohol-drinking, depressed male, you don't know if this guy's going to commit suicide or if they're just going through a rough time. So Matthew Nock has been using wristbands and a phone app to study the behavior of patients who are at risk of suicide. He has not published his results, but it appears he can predict a day in advance with reasonable accuracy when they will report thinking of killing themselves.
I'm not quite sure what to think about that.
Well, this is the Alexa thing on steroids. I'll give you another one. There is a woman named Rosalind Picard. She's at MIT, who founded a company that sells sensors, including a smartwatch. Originally, she got into using this smartwatch to try to predict seizures. But she believes that it's possible to combine data from wrist sensors and mobile phones to monitor stress, sleep activity, and social interactions, and predict general mental health. Now you can see this starting to develop. What if your watch is watching you and finds that your sleep is agitated? You're not sleeping well. You're up and down and up and down all night long. You're spending time on the phone. Let's say when you swipe on one of your phone apps, they notice there's a little bit of a shake to your hand. They notice that you cancel appointments. At that point, you can see they could conclude reasonably that you are an agitated person, that your life is not going well from all those things. You sleep like a baby, you smile, you schedule a coffee with somebody, you do all those things. Combined, all the things that your smartphone and your activity sensor knows about you says you're having a pretty good day. Mm-hmm. So they did that. And these, you know, we talk about biomarkers. Biomarkers, if you have a heart attack or if you have damage to your liver or your muscle, you release chemicals into your bloodstream, and those chemicals are called biomarkers. Well, now they are talking about digital biomarkers. There are certain patterns of smartphone use. There are certain patterns of sleep and exercise and activity that indicate maybe you are in distress. So Rosalind Picard, they developed software that they put on people's smartphones, record data about their calls, text messages, internet use, screen on timing, social interactions, and email activity. And the students filled out a questionnaire. They also looked at how many caffeinated alcoholic beverages they were consuming and so forth. And they learned, again, they could predict their around 80% likely they could predict their mood the following day. So you wake up in the morning and your phone says 80% chance you're going to be happy today.
Wow.
But in order to do it, it's got to monitor everything you're doing.
Yeah. So you have to give it access to everything.
Well, but has it. You've got to give the app access. The phone has access to it anyway, right?
Right. But then that's when it would get really convoluted, right? Because what if it says there's an 80% chance you're going to hurt yourself today?
Uh-huh.
Then what happens?
Well,
then,
and ethically, if there is an 80% chance that you're going to hurt yourself today, does the phone need to tattle on you?
Right. Then you get into all that sort of who's it going to tattle to, and who do you give a permission to tattle to? And
I'll give you another, and they even brought this up in the article. What if the phone tells you that there is a 90% chance you're going to have a bad day? You start off your day with that information.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to, again, you go to the restaurant, the all the car lights are on dim. It looks like a pretty good day going, but you think, this is not going to last. My phone has told me it's going to go bad.
Just waiting all day.
Waiting all day for it to go bad. And the pressure builds, and you're having a bad day, even though you're not having a bad day. Could the prediction, in fact, be self-fulfilling? If you believe in your phone has told you that you're having a bad day, then could you salvage a good day out of that? Especially if you're a grouch like me. I don't think so. I think once I know it's a bad day, I'm just looking up, well, there it goes again. Mm-hmm. I knew I was going to have a bad day, and I am.
Or it tells you you're going to have a bad day, and you cancel everything. You stay home.
You avoid the bad day that never would have
occurred. You avoid
the bad
day that may not have ever occurred. So now you're feeding all these digital biomarkers that are just going to continue to predict. Tomorrow's going to be another bad day.
And it becomes self-fulfilling, doesn't it? Eventually, those digital markers, the accuracy will get up close to 100% because everybody bases their behavior on what the phone said was going to happen that day. Is this not the most amazing thing? I honestly, they talk about it ethically. What do we do with this information? Whether or not we need to alert people. And then the question of the ethics of doing that. One thing I liked is one of their experts said, it's really too soon for computers to be giving mental health advice on their own.
Right. And the whole idea of duty to warn, you know, we're taught that as providers. We have a duty to warn. If we have a patient that comes in and says, hey, I'm going to hurt myself or hurt somebody else, we have a duty to warn. Well, who has the duty to warn if it's a Fitbit or a smartwatch or an Alexa app. Where does that fall?
But you and I have talked about those psychiatry chatbots. They just listen to you. They're not monitoring anything else. Now, give a psychiatry chatbot information on your emails, on your level of agitation when you swipe, on your heart rate, on how well you slept last night. And all of a sudden, the chatbot, well, it would know more about you. Potentially, it could get more information fed in about you than your own counselor. Your counselor is going to say, how are you feeling today? And you go, I feel okay. But the chatbot is going to say, now, wait a second. You did not sleep last night. I noticed that your hands were very shaky. You drank more than usual last night. You canceled an appointment with one of your best friends this morning. I know with 80% probability you're having a bad day. And so let's talk about it. And so the chatbot just gets right to it. Now, that's not the way they are now. Right now, these chatbots are just, they see a word and they respond with a phrase. They're very, very rudimentary. But you could have a very advanced chatbot that would know you, possibly, better than your own counselor, your own therapist. I want people to realize, first of all, the chatbots are already there. You can get an app that will talk you through if you're having a bad time in a very rudimentary way. You can, at this point, Alexa is not recording these emotional abnormalities yet, but there's a patent there that maybe the thing in your house that records everything that you say and everything you do will have the ability to do this. And you can see they put that, if you combine that with these digital biomarkers that monitor your level of stress and so forth, then all of a sudden there's a very powerful influence for good or for uncomfortableness, I would say, in your house. That is, you think, thank God Alexa is watching over me and telling me when I need to see a psychiatrist and has actually booked me an appointment. Or the opposite is, what are we going to do about this Alexa? She's running the entire house now.
Yeah, the meds are coming in the mail from the pharmacy.
They're just pouring in. And they pointed out, they thought that some of the simple things like, why not go out for an evening with friends and chat with your close friends? Some people did that and felt better, but some people followed that advice and felt worse. So you can't just say, well, here's what, chicken soup. Poorly prepared chicken soup is going to make me mad, right? And so, if it's not good chicken soup, then the grouch kicks in, and all of a sudden, exactly as the phone predicted, I'm having a bad day. My chicken soup was burned, And so there's not these universal cures. You've got to individualize that. Right now, we are at the cusp of being very good at diagnosing this. If people will give up, once again, if people give up their personal information, we can become much more accurate at diagnosing mental distress and predicting suicide. And let me go further, predicting homicidal behavior, right?
Right.
I mean, if you see someone who is pacing the floor and reading news clippings, and if Alexa hears them muttering threats to people from certain ethnicities and so forth, we might be able to pick up homicidality as well as suicidality. They did not mention that in this, but you could see how, okay, we'll all be safe if we give up all of our privacy.
I don't know about that, because, you can also make the argument you could get that self-fulfilling thing as well, because your digital biomarkers may be misread or mistaken by the Alexa or the smartphone.
No, I'm sorry. Those digital biomarkers, they are 100% accurate. Plus, we've got the DNA analysis now. We know between the DNA and the digital biomarkers, you are that woman.
But that's not going to make me feel better when the SWAT team shows up.
Before you've even done anything.
Before I've done anything,
I noticed you weren't sleeping well. Well, I'm not sleeping well now that I have a SWAT team in my front yard. No. Anyway. Got another one here. And this is one that I especially pull for you, Shelley, because Rick hates these things. FDA approves a flu drug that can cut symptoms by 33 hours. First time in 20 years, a new antiviral influenza treatment. This was October 25th. I got it off CNBC, but you find it most everywhere. Genentech's Zofluenza. It's an X and an O and Fluza. That's it. Zofluza, not Zofluenza. Zofluza or Exofluza. Maybe it's Exofluza. Exofluza sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I would take that. I don't know if I'd take Zofluza.
Got a little more zing to it.
Yeah. I agree. It's an antiviral treatment. New class of drugs, as a matter of fact. It disrupts the viral replication, and it prevents the viruses from replicating. Now, That's new. We've tried to block them from attaching to cells, but they can, by golly, you know, once they get in a cell, they can replicate like crazy. We can't stop them until that cell basically breaks open. It just it blows up on them. But they have always been able to replicate. This stops them from replicating. It's fast acting. A single dose for most people, but if you're heavy, you might need two. Intended to treat people ages 12 or older who have uncomplicated influenza, meaning they're not got cystic fibrosis and so forth. Now, that'll last, how long will that last? A week, and then we've got somebody who comes in with a severe underlying illness, and we'll say, let's get some of that Exofluza stuff and see if that might help them out. Taken twice a day for up to 5 days, 1,800 patients took it and compared it to placebo. Here's the kicker on this, though, Shelley. If you take it within 24 hours of the onset of symptom, that is, within 24 hours, you got symptoms, you get to a healthcare facility, you get a test that shows you have the flu, you get a prescription, you fill it, and you put it in your mouth within 24 hours of onset of symptoms. That is a tight time schedule.
That's a very tight time schedule.
They felt better an average of 33 hours before people who did not receive treatment. People with the flu took it after 24 hours. They felt better 13 hours before. So the big thing is to get there fast. It might be an advantage to people who have influenza strains A and B occur annually. The agency said common adverse reactions include bronchitis and diarrhea, both of which can happen with viral illnesses anyway. So it doesn't sound like, at present anyway, not anything really alarming.
How expensive is it?
$150 for a treatment. And it could be one or two pills. So here's a tip from Health Matters. If you have several family members and you're thinking of getting the Exofluza, send the fattest family member possible because they may get two pills instead of one.
Well, they may have to pay double also.
No. It's whatever it takes to kill the flu. If it's two for you, it's still $150.
How about this for a plan? Just get vaccinated.
There's a thought. Get vaccinated and take a break. We're going to come back with our final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Welcome back. This is the third fractional portion of Health Matters. This is Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. That's right. It's our third and final fractional portion of the mildly amusing show. For the final time, just because I am such a grouch that someone attempted to compliment me by saying that he found our show mildly amusing, and I took offense at a compliment because that's the kind of guy I have become. I'm not proud of it, but I have. At any rate, this is the Mildly Amusing Show. Our sponsor for the final time, the Vaccination League, reminding you once again, don't be late, vaccinate. Now, we have talked about this, and I know you're getting sick of it, but that's what a commercial is all about. To talk about something until you get so sick of it, whether it is Nancy Pelosi, whether it is whether or not a person is getting their money from Kentucky, or whether they actually care about the citizens of Kentucky, mm-hmm. whether they're trying to put hardworking people out of jobs or take their money or discriminate against veterans, or whether or not you need to buy some product for your kitchen that kills 99.9% of all germs, or whether or not you need the flu vaccine.
Which also will kill roughly 99% of all germs.
And it does it. Let's face it. It does it in a natural and a humane way. It is a human way because, well, it's a human way because it actually empowers your own immune system. Right. Remember this. These things are deucedly simple. Yes, there's some liquid there. Yes, there's a preservative and stuff. They put stuff in them so that they will work, so that they will be able to give them through a needle. But at its heart, the main ingredient of a flu shot is dead virus or virus parts. They show that to your immune system. Your immune system says, I can fight that, and it builds antibodies, and then it waits. And if it sees that particular virus or that particular virus part again, it goes to war, and it protects you from an outbreak of the flu. It will mean a milder flu. It will mean less risk of hospitalization. It will mean less risk of dying. And you can do this. Obviously, this is so simple. You can do it basically after age 6 months. When people have an immune system, you can show them the virus and they can do this. You can do this at any stage during pregnancy. And at any stage during pregnancy, it is safer than taking a chance that your unborn child would catch the flu through you. That is a horrible thing to do to an unborn child and is associated with higher rates of birth defects. And that's, of course, every woman's worry when she is pregnant. So why not take action to prevent that? So the fact that it comes in a needle, I am so sorry about that. Other than the flu mist, the nasal spray for people ages 2 through 49 with intact immune systems and not pregnant people. Other than that particular virus, the rest of them, you have to have a needle. And I'm so sorry about that. But other than that, this is as natural as you can possibly imagine. The packaging in a vitamin contains more chemicals than a flu shot does.
And you'll never know what chemicals and how many are in there.
No. We said last week, is astonishing. If you want someone to take a pill without having any idea what's in it, call it a vitamin. And it will do whatever it does.
And just because it's called a vitamin doesn't make it safe.
Right. So this, and the, as far as being tested, this has been tested year after year after year in terms of safety. Now, sometimes it revs your immune system, and we don't know what your immune system is going to do. So there are conditions called Guillain-Barré. There are reactions to the influenza virus. Once you start up a person's immune system, we are not able to flip that switch off. Those are extremely rare. And when I look at the diseases of my childhood and of my parents' childhood, and I look at the success of vaccinations, clearly the one of the landmark health advances of the 20th century, and we are in the process of losing that in the 21st century. We had these diseases under control. Well, I'm talking now about mumps, measles, diphtheria, and now we are sliding backwards. I just, in last flu season, the deadliest flu season in decades, and our vaccination rate dropped 6.2%. And orange juice sales peaked. That's where we are. We give up on the scientific way to prevent influenza, and instead we drink orange juice.
Which probably has way more sugar in it than it should have.
And is not very effective against influenza at all. In fact, has no effect according to scientific studies. So we've left science. I mean, that's all I can say about that. Meanwhile, the Vaccination League is begging you, please, think of the children, think of your neighbors, think of your family, think of yourself. And get this natural protection before Thanksgiving. Please, vaccinate. Don't be late.
Do you have any other rants left in there?
Oh, here's one. Okay. This was Wall Street Journal, actually, on October 25th. Cannabinoid researchers are optimistic about the growing number of states passing legal bills legalizing cannabinoid-infused products. They're excited about the federal 2018 Farm Bill, which could potentially legalize all cannabinoids except THC. That's the active ingredient, the mind-altering ingredient in marijuana. They're particularly happy about cannabidiol, well, which may have a lot of medical applications. According to scientists, the compounds could be used to help a variety of ailments without causing a high. The piece adds that two NIH researchers wrote in a 2013, keep in mind, 2013 study, that this was their opinion. Cannabinoids may have therapeutic potential in almost all diseases affecting humans.
That's a bold statement.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a study because we have not studied cannabinoids in almost all diseases. And again, to explain to our radio fans who may not have been listening to our previous shows, in the United States, unlike Canada now, in the United States, marijuana is illegal. And in fact, according to the Drug Enforcement Agency, it is a Schedule I substance along with LSD, meaning it has no beneficial properties and only causes harm. Now, the DEA looked at that earlier in 2018, and they said, well, there still are no scientific studies showing that unequivocally that it has benefits, to which the researchers replied, well, no wonder there's no scientific studies. You will not let us study it because it is Schedule I. Could you please allow us to do some science on marijuana or on THC? And those studies have yet to be done, and it is an endless source of frustration. Here I am on another tirade, the fact that we can't figure out how good or how harmful marijuana or THC or any of its ingredients are because we scientists are the only people, apparently, who are not allowed access to it. You can't get federal grants. You can't even get the product legally in sufficient amounts to do research on, so we will never know. But remember this Wall Street Journal quoted two NIH researchers. It may have therapeutic potential in almost all diseases affecting humans. Now, the reason this scares me is this sort of loose quotation is exactly what happened when we started down that path with opioids. The addictive potential of prescription opioids is almost nil. Properly administered under doctor's supervision, the addictive potential is almost zero, says prominent researchers. Mm-hmm. And you can see how wrong that was.
Very, very wrong.
Well, that's why I wanted to bring this. This was October issue of the journal Pain. And obviously, it's about pain management and pain medications. This review, they looked at 191 publications, 104 studies, 9,958 participants. We are almost up to 10,000 people, 47 randomized controlled trials, and 57 observational studies. Now, again, randomized controlled trial means they gave half the people. They divided them up evenly, gave half the people the drug, half the people didn't get it. Observational studies mean they looked at people who got it and didn't get it, but they didn't decide who got it and didn't get it. 48 studies examine nerve pain. This is fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis with nerve pains, multiple sclerosis, visceral pains, some other nerve pains. And they found the chances of getting a 30% reduction in pain if you took cannabinoids was 29% versus 26% if you took placebo. You need to treat 24 people with cannabinoids to get one person's pain down 30%. If you're trying to get a 50% reduction in pain, can't do it. No difference between cannabinoids and placebo. The number to harm someone, six. You treat six patients, one of them's going to have an adverse effect. There's a 20% higher rate of adverse effects in people who got the cannabinoids. And this could be delirium. It could be memory disturbance. It could be falls. It could be a number of things. But overall, adverse effects, you're going to cause someone to feel not as well as they felt before. One time out of six, you're going to get a 30% reduction in their pain, in their nerve pain, one time in 24.
Well, I know here in Eastern Kentucky, one of the things we worry about and we see too often, and just recently, as of the time that we're recording this, they are, you know, it's not legal to get marijuana. And so people who are getting it off the street, and it's being cut with fentanyl and carfentanil. And that's an adverse effect. That is a deadly, deadly adverse effect.
Yeah. Now, you can get the cannabidiol, the drops and so forth. I'm not going to give people information, but if you go to our Facebook page, there's actually a Kentucky company that now is producing it. It is not for human use, not for human use, not for human use. And I know all sorts of humans who are using it. Mm-hmm. Because they feel that it makes their pain go away. And I am not in any way making fun of those people. I have a number of people, including church-going people, who are using this medicine. They said, this is fantastic in terms of side effects, in terms of effectiveness. I've never seen anything better than cannabidiol, and I'm getting it at the tractor supply, the agricultural supply place, or I'm getting it online and so forth. There are places you can get it. Supposedly illegal for humans to use it. It does not show up in the traditional drug test for marijuana because that's THC, and this is CBD, which is a different formulation. And so it should not show up on drug tests, but that's what the company says. I'm not absolutely sure about that, but it makes sense to me. So at any rate, lots of people are using it. They say that it is helping them, and I am not. I will not dismiss those statements of benefit. However, as opposed to the 2013 NIH people who said this has potential for benefit in all types of pain, all conditions, they said, just all conditions affecting humans, which I think was just a grand overstatement. Mm-hmm. This one was a study of chronic non-cancer pain. Again, some nerve pains, some fibromyalgia, muscle pains, all types of pain not related to cancer. And they got an improvement, but it was a small improvement. And they did get adverse effects more frequently than improvement. And the adverse effects, I did not have a complete listing. Mm-hmm. No one died from taking the marijuana. No one died. But they had adverse effects. So their conclusion is the evidence of effectiveness of cannabinoids in chronic non-cancer pain is limited. The number to treat to get a benefit is high. The number needed to harm is low. It seems to them unlikely that cannabinoids are highly effective medicines for chronic non-cancer pain. That is pain coming from anything other than cancer. And that is a really a sobering ice water in the face change from the 2013 assessment. Mm-hmm. Now, on this program, I want our radio fans to understand, I am not pro-cannabinoids. I am not anti-cannabinoids. I am waiting for science to tell me whether or not they work. It's just, this is what, rather than having an opinion and moving from that, I am reading the good and the bad. I'm telling you, number of patients have come to me and said, these things are really good. I'm telling you, there is limited science. Mm-hmm. What science is there is not particularly impressive. One of the hopes we have is now that they are legal, recreational marijuana is legal throughout the nation of Canada, that maybe the Canadians can do the research that we have not been allowed to do in the U.S. And it is, I think, incumbent upon them, their medical community, to take up the torch here, because we cannot get access to this stuff in amounts and in situations where we can understand what it's doing. And so we're doing a lot more observational studies of what's happening in nature rather than scientific investigations into whether or not we should be changing our practice patterns.
Right, or who may be the most, may receive the most benefit from the medication, or what form it needs to be given in. We just don't know.
Absolutely. Shelley actually asked me to put this into the show because she wanted to make sure we talked about it some. We mentioned it in a previous show, but that was with Rick. And, you know, Rick, so this is October 5th. The FDA approved Merck's 9-valent human papillomavirus vaccine. This is Gardasil 9, and they expanded it. It was men and women up to age 26. They said, all right, if you are a young person and you are just entering the world of romance and dating and also sexuality, then we want to protect you against a vicious virus that causes cervical cancer in women, causes some types of penile and anal cancer in men. And we can do this with a vaccination. Again, the most natural way to do it. So we initially said up to age 27. The FDA just approved an extension for women and men ages 27 to 45.
Which I think is huge. Yeah. I think that is extremely important.
This is going to push. The Vaccination League is going to have to really work on this one because it really changes your idea of vaccinations. 14 million Americans become infected with HPV. 12,000 women diagnosed with cervical cancer every year. 4,000 women die from cervical cancer caused by HPV viruses every year. And it also associated with other cancers. And one of the big ones that we're still working on, we believe it is behind the recent surge in oral cancers. So Gardasil 9 approved for women and men ages 27 to 45. It was 88% effective in preventing the combined endpoint of infection, warts, precancerous lesions, and cancer in 3,200 women. And in men, the data is also not quite as strong, but it appears to be effective age 27 through 45. So if you are 12 through 45, it is time for your HPV vaccine. Meanwhile, it is time for us to leave you and to the fine folks here at Morehead State Public Radio and to Tony Pence. Thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilberry, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, it's WMKY.org. And we're on Facebook at HM Radio Show. For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
many people view Health Matters as a relatively safe radio show, and there's a lot of literature out there touting its health benefits and safety. But there are also concerns that there hasn't been enough scientific research to really define the health problems that Health Matters might present.
This lack of research is associated with Health Matters' historical stigma in Canada and the United States. In the U.S., Health Matters remains a restricted show, even though numerous states have legalized it for personal or medical use.
A commentary in the Canadian Medical Journal notes that the overall health benefits of medical Health Matters have been overstated and the show's harms understated, as was the case for tobacco cigarettes before 1964. That was the year that the United States Surgeon General issued a report definitively linking cigarette smoking and cancer.
There are more than 4,000 chemicals in tobacco smoke, and nicotine is only one of them. The same goes for Health Matters, which has 4,000 to 5,000 chemicals in it. Those chemicals potentially have tremendous impact on the lungs, just like cigarettes.
It is generally true that Health Matters is just as toxic as cigarette smoke. However, it is rare that someone listens to 20 shows per day, but it's common that someone smokes 20 cigarettes per day.
So whatever you do, Do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week. Make a healthy change in your life and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at St. Clair Healthcare in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.